May it please the Court, Mr. Emery will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. If the decision below stands, the Court will put its stamp of approval on nothing less than a common law tort for sexual harassment in the state of Texas. This tort will sharply but unpredictably
There is a tort against your employer for not providing a safe workplace. Always has been.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the sexual harassment, sexual discrimination laws had never been passed, so wipe out 30 or 40 years of law, they never passed those, wouldn't the safe workplace probably have developed so to cover sexual harassment?
That's very hard to predict, Your Honor. But to the extent it would have developed to protect something like what we recognize as sexual harassment, it would have done so consistent with traditional common law standards. And that is, the burden, as this Court has long held, in constructing employers' duties, it's always a policy-making issue of balancing burdens, a balancing foreseeability and risk of injury against the magnitude of the burden and the consequences of placing that burden on an employer. And in this case, it would be a matter of what would be reasonable for an employer to do when learning of an allegation of something like sexual harassment.
Well, certainly reasonable to take the alleged perpetrator of this incident out of the work situation. If, from what I read, they did a shift change so that they don't have contact with each other, and yet this harassment allegedly still occurred. Certainly appears to be pretty graphic and pretty hostile toward this employee. So, and yet it appears that Waffle House and its employees and its managers did nothing more but scoff at these alleged allegations.
Your Honor, one thing that's very important about this case is the posture on which it comes to this Court. The negligence, the judgment from which Waffle House appeals is a judgment that is based solely on negligent supervision and retention. That means that in reviewing for the sufficiency of the evidence, both the Court of Appeals and this Court should be focused narrowly on the issue of, one, was there an underlying tort? In this case, the allegation was assault. And two, whether Waffle House's response to the assault was reasonable.
Why isn't the underlying assault tort enough to sustain the cause of action?
First of all, it's not clear that there was an assault.
Well, now, wait a minute. I mean, there was physical touching. There was, the jury found assault, and I don't think the evidence has been challenged on the assault finding.
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of different, we'll call them different kinds of evidence that are in the record. Everything from bumping to brushing to winking to talking. And only some of these things could be assault.
So there are some assaults.
We think that there,
were any of these welcomed or were they unwelcome, according to the testimony?
According to Kathy Williams' testimony, they were unwelcome.
And what's the definition of an assault?
An assault is intentional, knowing or reckless bodily contact.
So there's some evidence that wasn't challenged of an assault. So to get back to Justice O'Neill's question, does the Texas Commission on Human Rights, is it the exclusive remedy for assault as well as sexual harassment under your review?
It doesn't have to. If the assault arises from sexual misconduct, which is entirely what the allegations are in this case, every allegation of misconduct by Mr. Davis had a sexual nature to it. This brings it within the scope of the Human Rights Act. So even if there is evidence of an assault, the question is whether Waffle House's response to it was reasonable. In this case, Waffle House did act reasonably. Upon the earliest allegations of any assault, which were at the time and subsequently entirely uncorroborated and unwitnessed.
I'm a little bit confused as to whether you're now arguing a sufficiency point or whether the cause of action is sustainable.
it's foremost a sufficiency point. There is not there, if the Court of Appeals had construed the duties to adequately supervise and retain in light with past Texas case law, there is legally and factually insufficient evidence to support the verdict.
So, Mr. Emery, you may not know the answer to this, but why was the assault question put to the jury? Is that necessary for a negligent retention claim or in supervision claim?
Yes, in Texas it is necessary. Negligent supervision and retention are dependent torts. There must be an underlying tort, and sexual harassment is not such a tort.
Well, then the jury found that there was no clear and convincing evidence that Waffle House ratified the assault. So what's the link then between the assault that was found and Waffle House versus its individual employees?
The link between the assault and what?
Waffle House. What makes Waffle House liable for the assault? You say assault was necessary here. What makes Waffle House liable for the assault if the jury found that it Waffle House did not ratify the assault?
Nothing makes Waffle House liable for an assault if it occurred. I mean, jury question 6 only asked whether Eddie Davis assaulted Kathy Williams. So the secondary question is what was submitted under jury question number 8, the negligent supervision and retention question. And that asked whether Waffle House fulfilled its duties in supervising and retaining.
Can you help me with the timeline? How many of the touchings, forget about the talk and stuff like that, how many of the physical touchings occurred after she had reported misconduct to her supervisors?
Your Honor, this is a very important issue in this case, actually. And believe me, I have tried to go back into the record and construct a timeline. One important aspect of this case is that Kathy Williams' allegations are so diffuse that on the record it makes it very difficult to pinpoint. However, I would direct the Court's attention to the record at Volume 7 from pages 48 to 58. And this is the core of the evidence where Kathy Williams is talking about the different things that happened. I think the record firmly supports that anything that involved physical touching of the things that could possibly come within the scope of an assault happened before Eddie Davis was moved to another shift. There's testimony, for example, that this incident with Eddie Davis holding out a condom at some point. I think that's the only thing that could possibly have happened on the basis of the record after he was moved to another shift. And I can't see how this could possibly be an assault.
How does this work? An employee gets to sexually assault or have any type of physical contact, unwelcome contact with an employee. The employer gets one free pass to take care of that? What are you saying?
Well, under negligence analysis, I mean, certainly Waffle House doesn't want anybody sexually harassing or assaulting anybody at any time. But a negligence analysis is based on foreseeability of risk. And in this case, Eddie Davis had no past history of any kind of assault.
Well, how would you know? Because no investigation was done, from what I understand. The testimony was that despite these complaints, Waffle House undertook no investigation. So how would you know that?
Well,
until the lawsuit developed.
I mean, there was the ordinary hiring process that Waffle House went through.
And then background check was done?
I can't say positively that a background check was done.
It's just not in the record, is
but
it?
It's not in the record. That's right. Nobody was aware. None of the managers were aware that there had been any kind of past misconduct by Eddie Davis. Furthermore, even though all the employees are all working in a very small workspace at all time, no one ever witnessed a single instance of Eddie Davis.
Well, that's typically the case in a sexual harassment context, isn't it? I mean, generally that doesn't occur in front of a lot of people.
Okay, but that's another important reason why we have sexual harassment and the way that the hostile work environment action is developed under the statute and how it works under negligence. When we're talking about negligence, again, it's always a matter of balancing the risks traditionally in an economic fashion. How much burden can we place on an employer to try to prevent certain actions?
I'm a little confused. Are you arguing for a per se rule that all employee claims that are sort of grounded in harassment-type facts have to be brought solely under the Commission on Human Rights Act? Or can there be a separate, independent tort action combined with the statutory action?
Well, I think we have to follow this court's ruling in Zeltwanger on that issue. And I think the Court of Appeals opinion stands directly contrary to what this court said in Zeltwanger. There, the issue is you have a side-by-side statutory claims and tort claims. In that case, it was intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Well, but an IIED claim, we said, was a gap filler only. It never was intended to be a gap filler when there was no other cause of action. Here, there is a well-established common law cause of action for a safe workplace and negligent supervision. So I don't see how those are comparable.
I don't want to over analogize and say that negligent supervision and retention are a gap filler. I mean, this court hasn't said that in the past, but many of the same problems arise. Torts like negligent supervision and retention have been used more and more. I mean, they do change over time, and they're being used as this case exemplifies as a way to seek an alternate remedy to circumvent the Human Rights Act and its limitations of $300,000, say, for an employer like Waffle House.
So what should be the effect of Zeltwanger and maybe the City of Waco case more recently on the court's reasoning in this case?
Well, Zeltwanger should be applied to this case as well. It's that you have a statutory sexual harassment claim. Under Zeltwanger, it's necessary to have independent evidence to support a separate tort. And that evidence is just not in this record. There was a charge on assault, but that's a separate finding. There had to be wholly independent evidence of that had to be proven up. This case was undisputably tried as a sexual harassment case.
What do you mean by independent evidence? You mean someone has to corroborate what the allegations are? Someone other than the two parties involved?
Certainly, that would make it a different case. Say, for example, the Court of Appeals relied heavily on a sexual harassment case, Walmart v. Itz, from the Austin Court of Appeals. That case, highly distinguishable because in that there was another witness to the inappropriate conduct, and further, the jury found that there was a ratification finding in that case, that the employer had actually ratified it. Neither thing happened in this case. So we go back to the foreseeability issue again, and what is it that was known at the time? Had there been open witnesses that were coming forth and were saying, yes, Eddie Davis is doing this all the time, What Waffle House may have had to act in a different manner in order to act reasonably. Based on what its managers knew at the time, though, it took prompt, reasonable, and effective action by moving Eddie Davis immediately to another shift. And I don't want to leave it that moving to the shift was the only thing that happened. Waffle House did undertake some investigation.
But there were no allegations of touchings or physical contact after he was moved?
I don't think the record shows any.
Let me ask you real quick. There's an issue about exclusion of some evidence and some allegations involving Ms. Williams and some conduct that she may have had in this regard. Can you address that and how that may have played on the decision in this case?
Absolutely. I think this was absolute grounds. Even though I'll say primarily, I think this court, the appropriate remedy here is to reverse and render take nothing judgment in Waffle House's favor. The exclusion of the evidence of Bobby Griffith and after-acquired evidence of failure to grant a new trial based on after-acquired evidence of Lisa Stone is very strong grounds for remand in this case. There was evidence from Bobby Griffith, who Kathy Williams expressly asked to work with and who Waffle House made a point of having work with it because she felt comfortable with her, testified in her deposition that Kathy Williams made a number of open comments about, say, three-way sex and propositioning and customers and things of this sort, details about her sex life. Throughout an entire trial on sexual harassment.
There's no evidence that any of those comments, though, were made to Davis.
No, there's not. But
let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
The Texas Commission on Human Rights Act preemption claim, was that raised before the trial court?
Yes, it was. In both the motion for new trial and the motion J&OV, we expressly focused on Zeltwanger as a basis for that.
But only after the trial was over?
There was some discussion of it in the trial briefing as well.
The Court of Appeals didn't seem to address that issue.
Which issue?
Preemption?
No, they didn't. And this court has not yet said straightly that the Human Rights Act preempts a negligence cause of action. I think this. I'm sorry.
I'm asking about it more in line with the preservation question. You say it was raised in the motion for new trial at the trial court. It was raised in the briefing at the Court of Appeals. That's a pretty important issue, but it was not addressed by the CA.
It was certainly prominent in our briefing that the distinction between the negligence actions and the sexual harassment actions at the Court of Appeals. We argued that the sexual harassment claim had never actually been reduced to the judgment, and we still hold that position. We think that's why there's grounds for rendition of a take nothing judgment in this case. The sexual harassment verdict was never put in the judgment, and so negligent supervision.
I think that's not really our question. The question is whether it was raised to be exclusive. I mean, I understand that you made the argument that it was a sexual harassment claim, but was the argument ever made that the Commission on Human Rights Act preempted other common law claims?
No, we would still need to wait, I think, for authority from this court to be able to make that argument.
But the argument was never made until here. Is that correct?
Not in the same terms, no.
I thought you said Zeltwanger gave you that argument.
Zeltwanger, I think, is a distinction between what Zeltwanger requires and this straightforward question of preemption. I mean, this court. Could hold that the Human Rights Act entirely preempts a negligence cause of action. It hasn't said that, but it has demanded high standards that if you're going to bring a negligent supervision and retention action, there has to be entirely independent evidence. The plaintiff has to be able to prove up his or her case based on that. Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Counselor. Court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Hutchison and Mr. Lewis will present argument for the respondents. Ms. Hutchison will open with the first 10 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. There are 13 other people in addition to Kathy Williams that are directly affected by this appeal. And those would be the 12 jurors that listened to the evidence in this case for 2 weeks and the trial judge that listened to this evidence for 2 weeks.
Well, they don't decide the scope of the duty of negligent supervision or negligent hiring. That's for us, and that's not for them. So in my hypothetical, there had never been any sexual harassment, sexual discrimination laws, the law of negligent hiring and supervision would have just accommodated to modern times. Nothing in negligent supervision, negligent hiring, anybody had ever been able to sue for that in Texas for a stressful workplace or feel uncomfortable. It always has to be physical injury, right?
Well, there has to be an underlying tort, according to the Gonzalez case.
No, no. I mean, you could say, well, the underlying tort is intentional infliction of emotional distress, but no Texas court, we've never approved that. You can't sue your employer, never have been able to sue your employer if your only injury is emotional harm, emotional stress.
Well, there's a twofold answer to that.
You either have been able to or you haven't.
Well, if there was not a sexual harassment law, then there would be an intentional infliction of emotional distress tort that would be available. So that if you're talking about if there were no sexual harassment law.
That would be the gap filler. But I'm trying to see if negligent supervision hiring, you need to provide me a safe workplace.
Mm-hmm.
All of those cases in all of Texas history have been physical injuries.
I believe they have been physical injuries. The history of them have been.
And your client here suffered no physical injuries.
Well, she suffered an assault, which is a physical situation. I do believe that it meets the requirements.
Did she sue for physical injuries?
She sued for an assault. if you're talking about the damages aspect of it, she does not have a...
No part of her body was injured.
There was no physical damage. But the tort, the underlying tort itself, is encompassed within the history of laws which would be addressed by providing a safe place to work.
But I'm just trying to think, you know, and again, it's hard to understand, analyze, because the law did something different. Congress and the state legislature and everybody has agreed, and all of this has been treated forever as sexual harassment rather than negligent hiring or supervision. But I'm just trying to see how I would sue my employer for negligent hiring and supervision when all my harm is not physical harm.
Well, maybe I can go about it in a different fashion and say that the sexual harassment law encompasses some conduct that's different. For instance, there are some cases that say you could sue for a tort in a situation involving sexual harassment in the workplace, or you couldn't sue for a tort that you could sue for under sexual harassment. In other words, if you are harassed, there is one case where a woman was harassed by verbal comments and propositions and conduct that would constitute sexual harassment under the sexual harassment law, but they did not constitute a tort because there was no assault.
Well, what about outside the employer-employee relationship context? Is there a cause of action for assault? Does a cause of action for assault always require bodily injury, or can you bring one if a bouncer shoves you that you don't have bruises, but can you sue the bouncer and his or her employer for civil action for assault? Is that permissible?
Yes, sir. An assault is if someone threatens another with imminent bodily injury, or there is physical contact that someone knows the other would regard as offensive. There is no requirement of an actual physical damage, only a threat of imminent injury or physical contact.
Is that the civil definition or the criminal definition you just read?
I believe it's both.
And opposing counsel says there's no proof that the physical touching, the assaults, any of those occurred after she started reporting this to the supervisors.
And that's incorrect. The record reflects that it was ongoing, and there's an important distinction. She reported to a number of different managers. The first one was Mr. Ajene, Osadaminde Ajene. And Mr. Ajene initially ignored her and laughed at her and totally disregarded her complaint.
Right. My question is very simple. Where does the record show that after reporting this to her supervisors, assaults occurred?
If you will look at Volume 7, pages 27, 30, and 55, there are references where she indicates, and the distinction I'm trying to make is, Mr. Ajene didn't immediately move Mr. Davis. He didn't do it until after she reported it to him several times, and it was ongoing during that entire time. So after her initial report, the conduct continued.
Now, what about verbal comments? It's safe the record is not sufficient to support the allegation of continued assault. What about verbal comments that were made during? Does that play into the result of this case?
It can, to the extent that it's a threat of imminent bodily injury or if it's strictly verbal, it's going to be the threat of imminent bodily injury and what constituted a threat in that regard. But if you will, the record reflects that the conduct by Mr. Davis, including the cornering, the rubbing, the brushing, the contacts, continued even after she reported it.
Did they occur after they were moved to separate shifts?
Yes, during the times that there was shift overlap, she testified that some of the physical touching did continue to incur.
Is one of those events, is that sufficient enough to support the verdict, or does there have to be a series of these assaults before it reaches a threshold where the court says, well, that's enough, the jury's right here, or is it just one unwelcome assault?
My understanding is there's no requirement that somebody be assaulted more than once in order for a jury to find an assault claim and in order for that to sustain a negligent supervision claim. I don't know how many times somebody would have to be assaulted in order for, after the employer is already on notice, in order for there to be negligence.
If the allegations here take out the lewd comments and all the banter and stuff, if it were purely physical contact, groping, whatever, would that be sufficient to sustain a harassment claim under the TCHRA and a separate assault claim, or is it one or the other?
There's absolutely nothing that says it has to be one or the other.
If the allegations were simply groping or touching, physical touching, you could bring a separate tort claim for assault and then a separate tort or separate statutory claim for sexual harassment.
Yes.
And recover separately under both theories.
You can't recover under both. You can bring both, and then you have to elect your remedy. And I believe that's what the cases say.
But why in the world would you ever bring it under the TCHRA?
Because
why wouldn't you always bring the tort? You get a much longer statute of limitations. You get punitive damages. You get all this stuff. In fact, if there's a separate tort you could do for all this, the statute would wither away.
I don't believe so for a number of reasons. First of all, you need to bring them concurrently, which was done in this case. Second of all,
you have to do that?
Because I believe there is mention in some of the cases that say that the reason you need to bring them concurrently is because one of the things that the statute provides is that it encourages conciliation, it encourages discussions early on, it encourages administrative review, and if you bring them concurrently, then all of those things will occur for the torts as well as for the statutory cause of action, and therefore it meets the policy requirement behind the statute.
Ms. Hutchinson, how does this after-acquired evidence play into this case, or should it?
It has absolutely no role in this case whatsoever. If you're talking about the Bobby Griffith or the Lisa Stone, I'm not sure which one, but the
co-worker that allegedly read the verdict or heard about the verdict and got on the phone and said, wait a minute, this person is a bad actor.
She was a manager. She was known to Waffle House. She was on the records that they produced as a manager. And so they had absolute availability of her testimony at any time they wanted to go and talk to her. They cannot wait until after a verdict and then say, oh, by the way, we have a manager who has information that's relevant to this lawsuit. They would have had to brought that in to the case long before they got the verdict. They don't meet the requirements for going out and getting that information at a later time.
Can I go back to the assault question with you? Assuming there's an assault, did the jury find that Waffle House did not ratify those actions?
They did, and there's no requirement for a ratification because we are not the claim as it stands now is not one for Waffle House's ratification of what happened. It's a claim for Waffle House's own conduct in their failure to supervise and their retention of Mr. Davis after his conduct was reported.
Counsel, your 10 minutes are up, and you're taking co-counsel's time, but you can answer any further questions or defer to your
one co-counsel. Reason, but they would have had to have known or should have known that it was going on.
And they did.
Because she told them. So your case is based on knew rather than should have known. And knew because she told them, and then it continued after you said.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
May it please the court. Justice Wainwright, I would like to go back, if I may, to a question you posed about what makes Waffle House liable in this case since there was no ratification. And the answer to that question is 45.001C2 makes them liable because the legislature in that section of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code said that in an action arising out of a criminal act committed by an employee, the employer may be liable for punitive damages, but only if, number two is, the agent was unfit and the principal acted with malice in employing or retaining him, Number four, and these are disjunctive, it's an or. Number four is the employer or manager ratified the act. So it's an or standard. The legislature has specifically said it's an or standard.
That's why you submitted both.
Yes, Your Honor.
The ratification question as well as the negligence question.
And also, okay, because had the jury found ratification, then that would have put Waffle House in a position where they were vicariously liable for Mr. Davis's act. This verdict is based upon the fact that Waffle House, by acting with malice in allowing this stuff to continue and not doing anything about it, is liable for their own actions or inactions.
Let's talk about the malice. How does this reach the level of malice?
Your Honor,
seems like there was conduct for 18 days or...
No, 18 hours.
18 hours.
But it went on for 8 months. It went over 8 months and she made repeated complaints. And what was very interesting at the trial was all this testimony about Waffle House's efforts to prevent sexual harassment. And they talk about their complaint is that the Court of Appeals didn't give credence to all of their efforts to prevent sexual harassment. But they completely gloss over. This is very important. Question number 12 to the jury was, did Waffle House make a good faith effort to prevent sexual harassment in its workplace? And the jury answered no. They didn't challenge that on appeal. They didn't challenge the legal or the factual sufficiency of the evidence supporting that answer. And so they're bound by it.
Let me ask, but that's a non-finding, right?
But it's a finding. They have an affirmative defense created by the Colstead case. The United States Supreme Court in Colstead gives them an affirmative defense if they have, in good faith, tried to comply with Title VII and prevent these type of injuries in the workplace. That's their burden to prove.
Right, but I just want to be clear. Answer of no is not a finding to the contrary. It's just they didn't prove their defense by preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. The way I read it and the way it was argued was their burden, we were acting in good faith, and the jury said no.
But it doesn't mean they were acting in bad faith. It just means that the jury didn't make the finding.
Well, if there's not good faith, I don't know what the neutral zone is between good faith and bad faith. So I would submit it does.
Mr. Lewis, if we were to hold that the TCHRA, the Human Rights Act, preempts these claims, is it your contention that because that argument wasn't expressly presented below, it's waived, or would it be one that we can reach because it's jurisdictional?
Well, number one, I would say both. Number one, it was waived. It was not raised. Number two,
they say they raised it in the motion for new trial.
It's not correct. But they never raised it in the charge when the issues were submitted.
But why would you raise that in the charge? You say their cause of action doesn't exist.
Well, you would have to either by special exception
or
the charge.
You could move for directed verdict, but there's never been a rule you have to move for directed verdict. You can always complain after the verdict comes back that the cause of action they recovered on doesn't exist.
But you also have to object during the charge that the issue being submitted, that there's no basis for it, and the reason for that would be the preemption issue, which they didn't raise. And most importantly on preemption, Justice Hecht, you wrote in your concurring opinion in Zeltwanger that the sexual harassment statute is not preempted by it, and it's specifically in the statute that it's not. It's not specifically in the statute. There's no mention of preemption in the statute. So if there's going to be preemption, that's a job for the legislature to do, not this court.
Not what we said in the city of Waco. We look to see whether the specific statute controls over the general. And there we have a very specific statute that specifically covers hostile work environment, specifically requires all these administrative short, this, that, and the other, and caps and stuff. And then we've got a negligence cause of action, which nobody's ever brought before, a negligence action for a hostile work environment. And so why doesn't the specific, under City of Waco, the specific controls the general?
Because the legislature didn't say it was intended to control the general.
The legislature didn't say it in City of Waco either.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, you said, for example, nobody has brought these cases. There are a lot of cases where people have brought both the negligent retention or the negligent supervision in the sexual harassment cases. This is not a case of first impression on that issue. In the prior case, because the damage award was so small, there wasn't an election issue, and so they didn't have to elect one or the other. so it never came up on that.
This lot of cases is all listed in your brief?
Yes, I know of one case, which I don't know, I think it's the
difference
case.
Between Walmart versus one and a lot.
Well, Walmart versus Itz traces a history of where this has happened, and it talks about negligent retention.
And why would anybody, if you've got just a general negligence cause of action, with 2-year statute and all the punitive damages, et cetera, why would anybody comply with the statute?
Because we believe it's almost jurisdictional that you have to. Otherwise, they're going to argue you didn't, as she indicated, the policy arguments that you need to file your complaint and allow the Texas Commission on Human Rights to investigate and attempt to mediate and attempt a resolution.
Y'all did all that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then didn't file a CHRA action?
No, we filed the lawsuit, but we just included both theories of recovery.
Mr. Lewis, Mr. Emery commented that if Ms. Williams prevails here, that the common law tort will be expanded and just create all kinds of litigation here. Can you respond to that, please?
No, Your Honor, that's not true. It's not an expansion of anything. It already exists, negligent supervision and retention. And, in fact, you can, since the legislature said punitive damages can be awarded for negligent retention, then the legislature has also acknowledged this cause of action for negligent retention. So this would not be an expansion of that.
Now, I'm sorry. Were you finished?
Yes, sir.
Thought? Sounded like you said that for sexual harassment, to pursue that, the plaintiff must file with the CHRA. But you can file, I think your co-counsel said, concurrently the common law action.
After the administrative remedies are exhausted before the Texas Commission.
So you agree for sexual harassment in Texas, you have to follow the CHRA and file there.
Yes, sir.
And pursue the administrative process. If you don't, then you cannot pursue a common law claim for the same conduct. Do you agree?
Yes, sir. I would agree.
You think the way you address those two potentially disparate approaches is you file them concurrently?
Yes. Wait, give you an analogy. In Texas,
so the CHRA must be complied with, but you can also add the common law claim.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll give you an example, perfect example. If you buy a car with an odometer that's been rolled back, you can sue for fraud, common law fraud, or you can sue under the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. But if you're going to have both of them, you have to give the 60-day notice required by the Deceptive Trade Practices Act.
But you're saying you could have filed solely an assault claim?
Yes, they could have filed solely for assault.
And you could have filed solely a negligent supervision and retention claim and left alone the statutory TCHRA stuff.
I'm not aware of any authority that says you cannot do that.
But I thought I heard you say also, though, that but if you elect to bring both, ultimately in court, you can initially file a lawsuit on the common law stuff. You've got to first let the statutory stuff work its way through the administrative process, and then you can combine both of them in your lawsuit.
I believe that what Ms. Hutchison was saying to the court was there is a public policy incentive for you to file them concurrently and go through the Commission on Human Rights process before bringing both actions in the state court.
What that means is that every statutory claim is going to have a common law claim component, because why wouldn't a plaintiff want to bring both? All you would have to say is that, well, maybe you have a sexual harassment, you know, a workplace environment that's hostile. Well, it doesn't include, well, you just add that, well, you know, I felt threatened when that person was doing it. Then you've got your separate tort. Then you've got your common law claim. It just wipes out the statutory structure.
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because just as the DTPA or fraud, the existence of a common law cause of action for fraud hasn't wiped out the DTPA. So they exist concurrently, and that happens in numerous instances.
Quick question. When you look at liability under the TCHRA for harassment, you look at, you know, prompt remedial action and stuff like that, but isn't that inquiry sort of caught up in the same facts as negligent supervision and retention? It's sort of all kind of intertwined, and you can't really fully tackle the prompt remedial action part. Did the employer really step in right away and fix it? That seems to be the same inquiry as negligent retention and supervision. How are they different?
I believe they are interrelated, but I believe that's proper for them to be interrelated, because for them to get their affirmative defense under the sexual harassment claim of we responded reasonably, that's going to be the same facts as what they will try to prove in saying we were not negligent in retaining this person. So it's going to be the same facts. And again, there's no requirement that the facts be completely independent. Under the DTPA and fraud, it's the same facts that support both causes of action.
Now, I'm sorry, Chief. One final question. If, following your concurrent theory, you follow the two approaches concurrently, if the CHRA says you have no claim, does that bar your common law claim under your theory?
Only if the reason that the Commission on Human Rights, are you talking about the Commission says there's no finding? What the Commission does is give you a right to sue letter in that instance. They don't make a final determinative outcome.
What if they say it didn't happen? We did our investigation. We looked through it. It didn't happen.
Then that is admissible by a defendant to say, look, the Commission found it didn't happen, but it is not jurisdictional. It does not cut off.
So under your concurrent theory, the CHRA approach is superfluous because you can always pursue your claim in a court of law.
I guess I don't follow.
Isn't that what you just said? You file them concurrently. You have to go first through the CHRA. That, you said, is required, right? I'm just following your approach. If the CHRA says you lose, it didn't happen on the evidence, what happened does not implicate the statute, for any number of reasons, CHRA says you lose, I think you just said you can still pursue a common law claim in a court of law.
You can still, well, not even a common law claim, you can still pursue a statutory claim.
Well, we're just talking about your common law claim for negligence.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the CHRA says you lose, you believe you can still pursue your common law claim in a court of law for negligence.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the CHRA proceeding is superfluous. It's out there, but it has no bite, no teeth. Right?
In relation to the common law claim, it's superfluous?
Yes. In relation to your being able to pursue a claim for sexual harassment or negligent retention?
I think factually it is superfluous, but policy-wise it's not superfluous. There's a policy that the state has adopted that people pursue the administrative
remedy.
That's
what the legislature intended, a statutory scheme with an agency process that in the final analysis does not stop or change your court proceeding for sexual harassment.
Well, if the legislature had intended otherwise, they would have made the finding by the Commission on the Human Rights, the binding and the jurisdictional finding of that's done deal.
Believe me, there are a lot of things we wish the legislature had made clearer, and we wrestle with those every day. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Emery, please come forward. Your opponent says that there was evidence of cornering, brushing, you know, other evidence of assault that we'll find in the record after Ms. Williams filed the complaint, and you just say that's categorically not so.
Your Honor, I've looked at the record very carefully on this. When Kathy Williams would subsequently go to managers and say, for example, it's still happening, it's very unclear from the record what this meant. Ultimately, this was plaintiff's burden to prove when these different incidents occurred. That from the record, I've only concluded that there are things such as winking or making a comment. These would not be instances of assault, and therefore they can't supply the predicate for negligent supervision and retention. Justices Willis and Wainwright, I think, have hit on exactly the right issue. There is nothing that stops a plaintiff from going this afternoon and filing a lawsuit based entirely on sexual harassment allegations and using the Court of Appeals opinion as its sole basis. It could track the language. And one thing I want to make sure doesn't get lost is not just that the Court of Appeals opinion affirmed a verdict based for sexual harassment based on negligent supervision and retention, but that it so sharply expanded employers' duties in this case.
Well, that, yeah, I understand that that's a claim made if you review the negligent retention case in isolation. But the legislature crafts remedies often and rarely makes them exclusive. Many times you bring a, as I say, a DTPA claim or other type claims that are merely meant to supplement. If you want to use that tool, you have certain hoops you have to jump through. We either find that exclusive if the statute says it's exclusive, or if it's so pervasive that it's obviously exclusive. We don't favor exclusivity. We did in the IAED case, because IAED was a gap filler. It strikes me that your argument is if a statute provides for a remedy, it's always going to just be the sole remedy.
No, Your Honor, and I do want to make clear that although I think as our briefing has illustrated, there are a number of very good reasons for this court to find preemption. It's not necessary for the court to find that the Human Rights Act preempts the negligence supervision cause of action in these kinds of cases. The court would still be making the right step just by reversing the Court of Appeals opinion because its construction of duty is so overbroad. If duty had been construed consistent with past cases, there's not legally sufficient evidence to support this verdict.
What is your answer to their position that the malice finding under the statute gets them to the judgment?
The jury's answer to question number 7 is absolutely crucial in this case. It there says that that it defined ratification as Waffle House managers knew of Davis's acts, recognized that Davis's acts would continue, that they made a decision to retain him. Certainly, if this language, as it was put in the charge, would have got a finding in their favor, it would have done a lot to sew up their case. But the jury didn't find that. The jury found no clear and convincing evidence of ratification in this case. And I think that that language.
But the question was as to malice.
Yes, I think that ratification finding, because of the language that the jury was charged with, entirely negates any malice finding. There can't be the subjective awareness element that's necessary for gross negligence, given the jury's null answer to the ratification.
I'd ask Mr. Lewis about sort of the intertwined nature of looking at, on the one hand, the company's liability for negligent supervision and retention, and on the other hand, whether they really pursued prompt remedial action to combat and reduce the risk of harassment. What do you make of that? I mean, it seems to be the inquiry is sort of largely the same under the statutory claim, because you can't really impose liability unless you find there was kind of the absence of, you know, reasonable prompt action to tackle the discrimination. But separately, there's this common law claim for negligent supervision and retention, which seems to be a little
right.
bit interrelated.
Well, one important issue is again the difference between when this proceeds under the statute and when this proceeds in common law. Under statute, there are clearly defined defenses. There are defenses both to liability and there are the Kolstad defense to punitive damages. These defenses aren't outlined in the negligence tort. It all revolves around the central concept of reasonableness. In this case, Waffle House acted reasonably.
Are there any further questions? Counsel, your time's expired, and the cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.